Productions. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities." Fellow Adamites, we have seen the cracks emerge in Babylon. We have seen the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, "Babylon the great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation." Today is August 1st, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here for Communism in Germany out of Nestor Webster. How are you doing today, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh.
Well, what we've seen so far, I think, is that we've seen the Jewish usury money behind the scenes in all the secret societies, especially the Masons and the Jesuits throughout Europe, engineer these revolutions. They engineered the French Revolution. They engineered the revolutions of 1848. And the French Revolution basically liberated the Jew as an equal citizen with the Christian in society. And I think that Napoleon exported that all over Europe. And that's the way I see it, and that's what I think that we've gotten so far from Nestor Webster. And we've seen the Jewish hand behind the entire overthrow of the feudal system. The Jewish hand in basically creating supposedly free market, right? Capitalism. And it's basically a Jewish takeover of European society.
Ruthless internationalism. And they would have, the mainstream historians would have the children believe that Marie Antoinette said, "Let them eat cake." The peasants were starving and weren't happy, and they just rose up spontaneously all at the same time on the same day. And that was the end of it.
And we've seen none of that here from this perspective. Not one bit. It's exactly the opposite.
They put out flyers saying the king requests that you riot, loot, and burn. He wishes only that his own chateau be left alone.
Basically.
So it's just a rent-a-mob. No one really knows how it gets there, but it's not there spontaneously. Someone ordered him to be there.
Right. So we've covered the 1848 revolution in France, and we saw the first experiment in Jewish socialism imposed on a European country failed miserably. The experiment in France failed miserably. And now we're in Germany and the role of the Jews in Germany and German social democracy and Marx and Engels. And we'll see who's really behind Marxism here, won't we?
Yes. Yeah, would you like to begin or shall I?
In order to follow the new course on which the world revolution now entered, it is necessary to understand something of the events that had taken place in Germany during the memorable year of 1848. We have already seen how the plan of the United Germany with Prussia at its head, originating with Frederick the Great, had been carried on not only by his successor, Frederick William II, but by the Illuminati, the Tugendbund, and the Masonic Lodges. Under Frederick William III, Master of the Grand Lodge of Prussia, a further pact was concluded between Prussia and Freemasonry. The Lodges judged that Prussia was, of all the states of Europe, the one most capable of carrying out their work, and they made it the pivot of their political action. The idea of a union under the domination never ceased to be the aim of all the Lodges. Yeah, you know, I don't know the answer to this question yet, but is that why the House of Rothschild was so hard on Prussia after World War I?
Quite likely.
That there is no Prussia. Okay, I'll continue reading. But it seems that in Frederick William IV, they encountered a rebel. Without this hypothesis, the agitation that took place in Berlin on the 18th of March, 1848, is incomprehensible. Why should the King of Prussia have become the object of a hostile demonstration led to the cry of a united Germany in which Prussia was to be supreme? Why should he have rejected as a crown of shame, a Standkrone, Shand Krohn, the imperial diadem, subsequently offered him by the National Assembly of Frankfurt, and have pressed the claims of Austria to supremacy. May not the explanation be that Frederick William IV had broken away from the traditions of the Hohenzollerns in refusing to ally himself with the subversive forces of which his predecessors had made such good use abroad, and that in preferring the claim of Austrian to Prussian supremacy, his motive was reluctance to make himself the tool of the Masons and to subscribe to their formula as expressed by Mazzini, Delenda est Austria. Now that means
Austria
must
be
destroyed. And let me explain that saying was borrowed from the Roman philosopher Cato, because he, every time he gave a speech in the Roman Senate, said, Delenda est Carthago, which is Carthage must be destroyed. So they stole it from him.
And now we're always hearing Iran must be destroyed.
Well, yes, it's always somebody on the drumbeat of international Jewry, that there's always an enemy, because there's always somebody that wants to resist their central banking system and not just turn over their economy to them.
Is Webster here, is she being an apologist for the Austrians, for the Habsburgs?
It seems more like she's she's being sort of an apologist for the Habsburgs, possibly, because she's laying this theory out that Frederick William IV wouldn't go along with the Masons in Prussia, and to go along with the Masons in Prussia would lead to a world controlled by the Masons, right?
Unless I'm mistaken, the Habsburgs were the first royals that began extending, you know, knighthoods to Jews.
Well, yes, the Habsburgs were very kind to Jews, and they were very Philo-Slavic. In fact, Adolf Hitler hated the Habsburgs because they favored the Slavs so much over the much more, as Hitler saw it, the much more productive Saxons.
So basically, the Habsburgs were a German family in Austria running the show, and they were trying to cater to the culture and the demands of their Slavic population in the Balkans at the expense of their Austrian-German population.
Well, the Slavs, you know, during the 6th through the 8th centuries, the Slavs had made a lot of headway down the Danube, and a lot of people along the banks of the Danube were actually of Slovak blood. I mean, it's not Slovakia for nothing. Slavic tribes actually did occupy much of the Danube at that early time. Now the Habsburgs are German by blood, but they did come to favor the Slavic people in their empire for some reason, and show them many kindnesses that later Philo-Saxon people, you know, Saxons who were nationalists, despised them for, and Hitler was the first among them, probably.
Well, just like our government, if you even can call it that, they're preferencing other people well ahead of us, aren't they? That they favor the Mexican who swims across the river with nothing but the shirt on his back over the people who have been farming this land for 300 years.
Well, right. And I don't think it's so damaging in the difference between Slav and Saxon as it is between American and Mexican, right? I mean, that's pretty horrible. At least the Slavs, that the West Slavs were a kindred race.
Here we're getting the short end of the stick, and they're preferencing brown people over us.
Well, right, but the Jews will always use the tribal divisions every time they can to cause to overturn societies. There's no doubt, and they'll always coax the majority into favoring the minority wherever they go, so that they could build up the minority, so that they can use them to turn over the common order, that the established order. That's what they do. That they create anarchy and destruction out of civilization.
All right.
The crown of shame, which he declined to wear when offered to him by the Frankfurt Assembly, under the President von Gagern, Freemason and member of the Burschenschaft, was the Masonic crown worn by Frederick the Great and his two successors, offered by the Freemasons of France to the Duke of Brunswick, and placed on the head of William I in 1871. But there was yet another consideration that may well have weighed with Frederick William IV. Freemasonry was not the only subversive force at work in Germany. Behind Freemasonry, behind even the secret societies that made of Freemasons their adepts, another power was making itself felt, a power that ever since the Congress of Wilhelmsbad in 1782 had been slowly gaining ground, the power of the Jews. Now here, Nestor Webster is separating the Jews and the Freemasons, but we've seen that the Jews have been behind all of the shenanigans in Freemasonry since the Illuminati were founded. Until the middle of the 19th century, the part played by the Jews in the revolutionary movement is more or less obscure. We have seen their mole-like working below ground during the first French Revolution, suspected by Prudhomme. We have seen them insinuating themselves into the Masonic lodges and secret societies. We have seen rich Jews financing the Haute Vente Romaine and needy members of the tribe acting as agents of Nubius. But every Jew is needy, isn't he? But at the same time, we have watched the building up of capitalism by Jewish hands and Jews in Russia supporting the authority of the Tsar. How are we to explain this double role of the Jews throughout the Social Revolution? The common theory that as victims of oppression, they embraced with fervor the doctrine of liberty and equality formulated by the lodges is completely refuted by Disraeli, Benjamin Disraeli, the future Prime Minister of Britain, in an illuminating passage. The Jews represent the Semitic principle. That's the first lie. All that is spiritual in our nature. That's two lies. They are the trustees of tradition and the conservators of the religious element. That's lie number three.
Well, in a sense, though, aren't they the traditional religious element of Satan? I mean, if
right, but that's the anti-religion, right? That they are a living and the most striking evidence of the falsity of that pernicious doctrine of modern times, the natural equality of man. Okay, four statements, and he told the truth once. Cosmopolitan fraternity, or as we should say today, international socialism, Disraeli goes on to observe, is a principle which, were it possible to act on it, would deteriorate the great races and destroy all the genius in the world. Disraeli told the truth again. The native tendency of the Jewish race, who are justly proud of their blood, lie number four, yeah, it's the most mixed blood in the world, is against the doctrine of the equality of man.
Well, here he's telling a bit of truth since they are against the doctrine, the fact they preach it.
They're only against the doctrine of the equality of man when it includes them. So he's sort of telling the truth there.
They want to be first among equals. You know, welcome to Animal House, where all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Right. Did you read that book? That was a great book, Animal House.
No, I've read a bit of it here and there.
It was a great book, and it's very true. I mean, the pigs and the goats, and they're acting just like that today, now that they're in charge here. They have also another characteristic, the faculty of acquisition. Is acquisition a faculty, or is just plain greed a faculty? Is acquisition a euphemism for greed here? I think it is. Although the European laws have endeavored to prevent their obtaining property. Well, right, because they prevented usury, right?
Exactly, because theft is a crime.
Right. They have nevertheless become remarkable for their accumulated wealth, stealing behind the scenes and under the table.
I'm going to say, if your only useful skill is bank robbery and you bitterly moan and complain that the state prohibits you from engaging in your trade, well, do you really have a right to, you know, complain? If all you know how to do is commit usury and fraud, don't be surprised when you're going hungry because the state's not going to sanction that.
Jewish mind, usury and fraud are perfectly acceptable. So you're stealing the Jews' vocation from them. They have nevertheless become remarkable for their accumulated wealth. And this is in 1860-something, 1850-something. I don't know exactly when this really made this statement. Thus, it will be seen that all the tendencies of the Jewish race are conservative. They're conservative if you're a thief. Their bias is to religion, property, and natural aristocracy. Right. Their religion, their property, and their aristocracy. Without any merit whatsoever, except being the best thieves on the block. In a word, then, the Jews are not genuine revolutionaries, but only throw themselves into revolutions for their own ends, greed. Whilst professing to believe in liberty and equality, they secretly deride such ideas, but make use of them to destroy existing governments in order to establish their own domination in religion, property, and power. Now, this isn't Disraeli. This is Nesta Webster's assessment of what Disraeli said, which is pretty much on the money. Thus, according to Disraeli, it was they who played the principal part in preparing the 1848 conflagration. And now she goes back to quote Disraeli. The influence of the Jews may be traced in the last outbreak of the destructive principle in Europe. An insurrection takes place against tradition and aristocracy, against religion and property. Destruction of the Semitic principle, extirpation of the Jewish religion, whether in the Mosaic or in the Christian form. Now that's absolutely incredible. The natural equality of man and the abrogation of property are proclaimed by the secret societies who form provisional governments, and men of Jewish race are found at the head of every one of them. The people of God cooperate with atheists.
Now, who is he referring to as the people of God?
Yeah,
is he trying to claim that Christianity is a Jew-inspired religion?
He's already said Christianity is a Jewish religion and the Jews are the people of God, yes. The most skillful accumulators of property ally themselves with communists. The peculiar and chosen race touch the hand of all the scum and low castes of Europe. And all this because they wish to destroy that ungrateful Christendom which owes to them even its name and whose tyranny they can endure no longer.
He's just a Jewish cynic, isn't he?
Yes, he's a Jewish cynic. And he got away with it, Prime Minister of Britain, for how many years? And this is all one lie after another. It's the worst thing that Christendom ever did was swallow the Jewish propaganda that the Hebrew religion was Jewish and Christ was a Jew. And it's not anything that happened recently. It's been going on for a long time, this propaganda. And we see Disraeli pushing it here in probably the 1860s, if I had to guess.
So here's Disraeli, who was raised in the Church of England after age 13. And despite that fact, he still basically poops all over Christianity and the scripture, doesn't he?
Right. And in fact, it's 1852 that this writing was published in a footnote. Well, right, but what was going on? What else was going on in 18? I mean, Sharon Turner was writing the history of Anglo-Saxons at this time, and Dr. George Moore published in 1860 the Saxons of the East and the Saxons of the West, and proved that they were the lost tribes of Israel at this very time. So at this very time that Disraeli's lying about the nature of the Christianity and the Jews, what we see the Israel identity doctrine that we profess starting to form.
And what a great Christian he turned out to be. He had numerous affairs with the wives of various noblemen, and then he married a rich widow after people were, you know, accusing him of being scandalous and bringing problems to Parliament.
And he spent 20 years flattering the Queen, right?
Hmm.
Victoria? Maybe it wasn't 20, but it was a long time. It is a favorite ruse of the Jews to represent the Christians as their only enemies. In reality, the persecution of the Jews began long before the Christian era, nor has it since then been confined to countries where the Christian religion prevails. So we see Nesta Webster swallows the typical belief that the Jews are the Hebrews of the Old Testament.
Well, if she thinks that they're intriguers and conspirators and liars, why would you believe them when they claim that they're the people of Moses? That's just one more conspiratorial lie.
Well, absolutely, but so many people have taken that for granted without going back and looking at the histories of Josephus and rereading their New Testament.
They'll tell you, oh, the Pharisees were lying when they challenged Jesus and when they told him that he was a liar and a false prophet and demon-possessed. But, oh, the Pharisees were telling the truth when they claimed that they're the people of Moses.
Yeah, right. It is incredible. It's absolutely incredible because it breaks the entire pattern. It breaks many patterns. The Jews have never built a civilization. If you look at the Bible, the Israelites had a civilization of their own for 400 years. Or longer, actually 300, actually about 600 years.
Have the Jews ever had a civilization? They just latch on to ready-made civilizations that other people have already built up.
They've never had a civilization. They've never built anything. If Christendom is to be accused of ingratitude for the privilege of harboring numbers of the chosen people in her midst, the pagan world showed itself quite equally ungrateful. Egyptians, Persians, and Assyrians kept them in complete subjection. And she's talking about the Old Testament history, right? She has it all wrong. Owing to their racial characteristics, it was found impossible, even under the more liberal regime of Alexander the Great's successors, to receive them into the community of nations. Now, by the time of Alexander the Great, by the time of his successors, Judea was already being usurped by the Edomites. The sullen obstinacy with which they maintained their peculiar rites and unsocial manners, writes Gibbon, seemed to mark them out a distinct species of men who boldly professed or who faintly disguised their implacable hatred to the rest of humankind. Here, then, rather than in Christian tolerance, may be found at least a partial explanation of the persecution of the Jews. Nor was the persecution confined to one side only in the war of Semite against Gentile. For given the opportunity, the Jews showed themselves in no way behind other races in cruelty. Quote, from the reign of Nero to that of Antoninus Pius, now here we're talking about the Edomite period, Gibbon says again, the Jews discovered a fierce impatience of the dominion of Rome, which repeatedly broke out in the most furious massacres and insurrections. Humanity is shocked at the recital of the horrid cruelties which they committed in the cities of Egypt, of Cyprus, and of Cyrene, where they dwelt in treacherous friendship with the unsuspecting natives. In Cyrene, they massacred 220,000 Greeks, in Cyprus, 240,000, in Egypt, a very great multitude. Many of these unhappy victims were sawed asunder, according to a precedent to which David had given the sanction of his example. Here follow details too horrible to transcribe. Under the humane rule of Antoninus Pius, the Jews assumed a behavior of peaceable and industrious subjects, but their irreconcilable hatred of mankind, instead of flaming out in acts of blood and violence, evaporated in less dangerous gratifications. They embraced every opportunity of overreaching the idolaters in trade. Since the earliest times, it is as the exploiter that the Jew has been known amongst his fellow men of all races and creeds.
Well, when she mentions Antoninus Pius, is this an instance where there's a usurper calling the shots and we would end up taking the flak for it?
Well, right. This is the Edomite period. It's definitely it's following the time of Nero.
Mm-hmm.
But by then, there are no more Israelite Jews.
And they often do these things, don't they?
They're basically all Canaanites, right.
They call themselves Greeks and commit horrible atrocities against various people. They call themselves Persians. They call themselves Romans. They call themselves whatever they need to call themselves other than Jews. You can call a Jew anything but a Jew. They commit atrocities in our name, and then we take the flak for it.
Well, right. And you know, a lot of commentators make the mistake that Nestor Webster's making here in attributing the captivity of Egypt and the Persian period and the Assyrian period to the perfidy of quote-unquote Jews. But you can't compare what happened with Assyria, Persia, and Babylon to what happened with the Canaanite Jews under the Roman period. Because Assyria, Persia, and the Assyrian Empire, real Israelites had many offices in Assyria, and that could be demonstrated, and in the Babylonian period and in the Persian period. The Persians were awfully kind to the real Judeans and never had a problem with them. There was never any problem with Persia and the people of Judea. There's not one recorded problem, period.
So Esther is spurious.
Well, the book of Esther is entirely spurious. It's a Jewish novel.
And it's basically, it seems to me to be a Jewish sex fantasy where hundreds of thousands of people are massacred and then they celebrate and have basically a feast and an orgy about it.
Well, right, that too.
I mean, only Jews would do that. Hundreds of thousands of people are dead, so great, let's celebrate, start passing the bread.
Right. Now, another thing, even though the Edomites did cause Rome a lot of strife, yeah, you know, you can't pick out the Jews, period, for causing Rome strife, because there were constantly insurrections against the Romans in Britain, in Germany, in Armenia, along the Euphrates River. And there were constant, nobody wanted to be ruled. Who wanted to be ruled over by Rome? Look at the king of Pontus rebelled against Rome, and 80,000 Romans were killed in the time of Sulla, about the ninth decade of the first century BC. I'm talking about 90 BC to 80.
Sulla, are you talking about Lucius Cornelius Sulla? Sulla the dictator?
Yeah. Well, he made his reputation defeating the king of Pontus. After I think it was like close to 80,000 Romans were slain. So the Edomite Jews weren't the only people to rebel against Rome. So I think that Webster's assessment here is extremely unfair. Even though we're talking about Edomites, which she's lumping them in with the true Judahite Judeans, and she doesn't know the difference of the Persian period and the Assyrian period, and the Egyptian captivity. And a lot of mainstream historians make that mistake, and they try to say, oh, this is all the perfidy of the Jews that did this. Well, the Egyptian captivity, that the ancient Hebrews had very little relationship to the Jews at the time of Christ, that's for sure. But they discount the 700 years that Israel and Judah were a great kingdom in Palestine, and didn't have an excessive amount of abrasion with the neighboring states. I mean, there were the skirmishes that happened are all mentioned in the Bible. They're all typical of any nation states at that time. That's just the way it is, and they're written into every ancient nation's history.
And it seems that the Romans took over basically every civilization they came into contact with, the Greeks, the Egyptians. They just could not overcome the Parthians, and the Parthians absolutely definitely were white back then. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, the Parthians were also Israelites, and that could be proven from real Israelites, not Jews, and that could be proven from the pages of Josephus and the classics. I got papers on my website that demonstrate it.
But we'll never hear about the uprisings by the various white people, the Gauls, the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Parthians. All we hear about are, a bunch of Jews at Masada, as though the Jews are some great warrior people.
Well, right. Exactly. And
I have to wonder, were those Edomites at Masada? Because it's pretty hard to get 900 Jews to commit suicide. You'd think that they'd try and bribe the Romans and use gold to gain another day of life.
Well, that's the Jewish character. I mean, anything but be a slave, right? Because that's where they were headed. That they would have been sold on the slave market if they were captured.
So in that instance, they will commit suicide.
Well, yeah, because they much rather they much rather be hosiery merchants, right?
They're not going to till the soil for a Roman master.
Well, basically, unless you understand the identity perspective. all comparisons of the Edomite Jews to the ancient Hebrews are invalid. And most of them are made with a great amount of bias. So Nesta Webster is not much better than any mainstream historians in assessing the history and creation of the people that call themselves Jews. But I mean, everybody's wrong about it. Unless you understand the identity perspective, you're going to be wrong about it. That's just the way it is. And our, yeah, you know, the Israel identity perspective is the only one that meshes with not only the New Testament, but also the histories of Josephus and statements made by Strabo and others about Judea in the first century.
And it may sound arrogant, but either your identity or you're some version of wrong.
Well, right. That's what it boils down to. Either your identity and you got a Jewish story right, or you're some version of wrong. That's a very good way to put it.
And some versions of wrong are closer to the truth than others, and some are just totally way out there.
Well, right, because all assessments of the people of the Jews discount the Edomites. They all do. Every one of them. Unless that they're through the Israel identity understanding, which is the only assessment of the history of the Jews that does not discount the Edomite presence in Palestine.
It seems that most people take for granted that the Jews are honest when they claim to be the Israelites. That the Jews are who they say they are, and they're not fibbing.
Yeah, but they lie about every other thing, so why wouldn't they be lying about that? It's the white nationalists, they'll say, oh, the Jews are liars, and they're no good scum, and they're infiltrators, and they're usurpers. They'll agree to all those things.
But they're people of the book, because the rabbis say so.
When you try to extend that behavior back to 2000 BC, they deny it. Even though they've operated like that ever since. Why wouldn't they be like that in 2000 BC or in the time of Christ or in 400 BC or any time period? If they've acted like that for 2,000 years, why didn't they act like that 3,000 years ago?
They were lying back then just as they're lying today.
Well, exactly. Well, I'm with Nesta Webster. Even where she's wrong, it's okay. She does good for her time. The truth is, then, that the Jews have always formed a rebellious element in every state, and not more so in those where they were persecuted than in those where they were allowed to dwell at peace. In fact, a careful study of their character throughout history shows that the Jew is well able to endure persecution with serenity, provided he is permitted to carry on his natural avocations, banking and gambling and prostitution, without hindrance. Whilst on the other hand, he finds it impossible to exist under a benevolent regime that limits his activities.
That's why they had to get rid of the Tsar. The Tsar was basically a benevolent regime, but they wouldn't let the Jews be Jews.
Benevolent regimes care about their citizens, maybe?
Well, if you care about your citizens, you're not going to let some rabbi molest a child and get away with it.
Exactly. This is almost funny for what she doesn't notice. Thus, in China, where the Jews were welcomed and allowed all the privileges of good citizens, the race found life unendurable because the Chinamen blandly declined to be exploited. The Jews, therefore, finding it impossible to gain control of the principal wealth of the country, a bunch of rice paddies. That's pretty stereotypical, isn't
or
it?
They had all the tea in China.
Yeah. Sought more congenial climates, and still today, outside the treaty ports, very few were found to be in China. I don't know about that. On the other hand, Germany has always been the favorite resort of the Jews. Well, of course, because the Germans are real Judah. Would that have anything to do with it?
And they're productive people.
Yes. If they object to persecution, how can we explain this fact? In no other country have they been so despised as in the Fatherland, which does not recognize the Israelites amongst its progeny.
They're not Israelites.
Yeah, right. We in England, living under a regime of tolerance and live and let live, unparalleled in any other land, can hardly conceive the bitterness or even the existence of the Judenites. The social peril is the Jew, was a phrase current in Germany. The Jew, said Treitschke, is our misfortune. Yet, and Judah, yeah, you know, it's a fitting element of biblical prophecy that the Jew is Judah's misfortune, is Germany's misfortune.
And that appeared on every issue of Der Stürmer, Die Juden sind unser Unglück. The Jews are our misfortune.
Well, who was the patriarch that had mixed with the Canaanites? Judah. Germany stuck with the Jew because of that. That's my view of biblical prophecy.
It seems that they follow the Germans everywhere they go. They follow them to Austria. They follow them to Argentina. They follow them to Brazil. Everywhere the Europeans, particularly the Germans, go, the Jews are close behind. And they're often hiding behind German names.
Well, of course. And do you think it was any different? I mean, Eli and I have been covering Ezekiel, and we've seen the Canaanite and Hittite presence mentioned several times in the prophecies of Ezekiel, and it's going to be mentioned several more.
I was reading there were even some Jews that went to South Africa and integrated into the Boer community, but I don't think they ever took to farming. I think they were mostly merchants trading goods to the Boers.
It's the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Edomites that corrupted Judah before the Babylonian destruction of the temple, as we see in Ezekiel and Jeremiah. It's the Edomite and Canaanite Jew that causes all the division we see in the New Testament at the time of Christ, and that's attested to in the New Testament many times. And it's in Josephus the historian that we have the truth of the matters. And it's the Canaanite, Edomite, Jew who has destroyed Germany, or sought to destroy Germany all throughout history.
Weren't we told that in the house of Israel there is whoredom and that Ephraim is defiled? Does it say anywhere that Judah specifically is defiled?
Well, yes, it does on many occasions.
And that curse has yet to be lifted.
Judah played the whore just like Ephraim did, but I mean, I believe that as we were told in various prophets, that most of that defilement was washed out of us in our trek to, through the Assyrian and Persian and the nations of the Assyrians, Persians, and Medes, and our regathering when those tribes broke off and crossed the Caucasus and around the Black Sea and became the Scythians and Cimmerians of Europe.
So biologically we're fine, but I'd say we're still spiritually suffering from this, and it's going to continue until the end.
Well, of course. I think biologically most Europeans probably have nothing to worry about as long as they were white when their ancestors got here, or as long as they're still in Europe and they're still white today, that most of us, the ones that are mixed with Jewish blood usually know it.
But, I mean, another 100 years of this, and you may have to look in the Swiss Alps to find the last few white people left in Europe.
I don't know if you could look at the Swiss Alps, because that's where the Swiss bankers, that's where they vacation, and they're not all Swiss. Okay, the social peril is the Jew, was a phrase current in Germany. The Jew, said Treitschke, is our misfortune. Yet in spite of these amenities, the Jew has found Germany, more than in any other land, his natural home. The reason may perhaps be found in the foregoing explanation of the Jewish point of view given by Disraeli. If indeed the Jew is a natural aristocrat, that's a joke, a disbeliever in the doctrine of equality, and an admirer of forceful government, he finds in Prussian imperialism a system which, though oppressive of his own liberties, wins, nevertheless, his confidence and respect. Here in the land of the jackboot and the spur, he encounters few of those enervating theories of humanitarianism, those disintegrating concessions to democracy, which he regards as, quote, deteriorating to the great mass races and genius of the world,
More likely, they're just hoping to hijack the system of discipline and regimentation and wind up being the ones that rule the people. Instead of the Junkers ruling the people, they'll rule the people by posing as Junkers.
Well, exactly. In a word, the Jew has always been inclined to regard Prussia as the best investment for his money. If only he could gain some measure of control over the great military machine, his position in Europe was secure. There you have it. It is thus that, as M. Claudio Genet observes, the Jews had always shown themselves the most active in the work of the unification of Germany, the Second Reich. And he quotes from an article devoted to the exaltation of Israel in the Journal des Debats, I'm sorry, I can't pronounce French to save my life, for November 5th, 1879, the following remarkable words. In Germany, from 1830 onwards, the Jews played an important part. They are at the head of young Germany. If German unity has been hastened by Prussian diplomacy and Prussian militarism, this work has been prepared, supported, and completed by them. Here, then, is the link between the apparently incompatible elements of Judaism and Imperial Germany. In spite of Judenheits, the Jews have always had a peculiar affinity with the Prussians, so that today, after the ending of the Great War, we find the Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung confidently declaring, that's a newspaper, confidently declaring that there is no contradiction between the desiderata of the Jews and German interests. Let me note that there's a PDF book available on the front page of the Mein Kampf project at Christigenia, mk.christigenia.org. And it's by Wilhelm Marr. And he was a journalist, a German journalist, in the mid-1800s. And he wrote a book that foresaw the conquest of Judaism over Germany. Now, that didn't really come into fruition. Of course, he couldn't foresee Adolf Hitler. And it almost came to be in the Weimar Republic, the Jews almost gained permanent control of Germany. But Hitler got in the way of that, and it came to fruition after American and English intervention in the Second World War. But Wilhelm Marr was pretty much he seems pretty much like a visionary. He saw it coming. He saw, in 1879 this book was published, he saw that the Jews were going to conquer and destroy Germany and rule over Germany one way or another. And there's a synopsis on the front page of the Mein Kampf site, which is written by Kevin MacDonald, borrowed from the Occidental Observer.
And the Jews had to gain control of Germany at that point then, didn't they, through military means. They had to bring the entire world literally down on Germany to punish them for daring to rally behind Hitler, a genuine patriot and nationalist, and rise up to throw them out.
Well, absolutely. They withstood Satan, and Yahweh said that our kingdom would be handed over to Satan, Revelation 17:17. I mean, there was no way around it. Hitler couldn't have known. He couldn't have known, but it was destined to fail. And we'd all be in better shape if Hitler had succeeded. But, you know, we would still have the Jewish threat. We would still have the Jewish problem.
We'd probably have 15 million more Jews in this country.
Yeah, well, yeah, right, that too.
Although I had a history teacher that said that Hitler considered all Americans to be racially inferior, mixed with Indians, mixed with Orientals, mixed with blacks, and his plan was to utterly destroy North America and kill everything that breathed. And that he discussed it in Mein Kampf, and she couldn't tell me what page it was on.
Well, of course she couldn't, because it's not there, because she's a liar. She read some lie from some Jew, accepted it as fact, like people do all the time, because the nice Jewish man, he wouldn't lie, and she repeats it as fact.
Well, I think she was a Jew herself.
Well, that's possible, too. But before this alliance, meaning the alliance between the German and the Jew, could be effected, it was necessary for the Jews to establish their position in the state, and for this reason, rather than from a spirit of revenge, they threw themselves into the revolutionary movement. It was they who provided the driving force behind a Masonic insurrection of 1848 in Germany, which started with the cry of Jewish emancipation and proclaimed as its ultimate purpose the supremacy of Prussia. This eventuality had been clearly foreseen by Disraeli, who in 1844 declared through the mouth of Sidonia, the Jewish hero of Coningsby, which is a book that Disraeli wrote. Disraeli liked to write novels. That mighty revolution, which is at this moment preparing in Germany, and which will be in fact a greater and a second Reformation, and of which so little is as yet known in England, is entirely developing under the auspices of the Jews, who almost monopolize the professorial chairs of Germany. So we see, by the time of 1848, the Jews had taken over the universities of Germany.
Just like they've done in this country in the last four decades.
Well, absolutely, and Christians never see their cunning. We can't imagine the average Christian in whom there is no guile, right? The average Christian cannot imagine the connivory of the Jew. So when he appoints the Jew to high places, he has no conception that the Jew is consistently going to use those offices to bring his Jewish brethren, whether they're qualified or not, into as many high places and offices as possible.
And it never occurs to them, oh no, there can't be people out there evil enough to want to brainwash my children and turn them into perverts and disgusting creeps.
Well, absolutely.
They just hand their children over to the beast.
4 years after these words were written, the revolution broke out in Germany exactly as Disraeli had foretold. And if it did not assume the proportions he had anticipated, the year of 1848 inaugurated the emancipation of the Jews in Germany as surely as 1790 had inaugurated it in France. And let me say that the Jews in Germany were emancipated to a great extent already by Napoleon. The accession to the, and it depends on what you define as Germany, right? Bavaria, the Rhineland.
Yeah, the German states.
Alsace-Lothringen, or Alsace-Lorraine, as the English call it. The ascension to the throne of William I, the protector of Masonry, quote-unquote, and the ministry of Bismarck opened a fresh field to Jewish activities. For the new rulers of Prussia realized that the Jews could be very useful to their cause. Hohenzollern tradition had always recognized the utility of the despised race as agents. Frederick the Great had not disdained to employ a Jew named Ephraim, no last name, for the purpose of coining false money. Well, that's what they are. They're professional thieves.
And isn't that what they do today? They print false money.
And every time a noble or a king wanted a professional thief, he'd go to a Jew and get everything he wanted. Probably the same Ephraim whom his successor, Frederick William II, had sent as a paid agitator to finance the tumults of the French Revolution. According to a strongly pro-Semitic writer in the Review des Du Monde, the Review des Du Mans for 1880, Bismarck had recourse to the Jews for replenishing his war chests, I'm sure at great expense. The Jews, the same writer goes on to observe, were the only people who were able to use Bismarck so that all liberal forms in Germany from Sadowa onwards carried out with the acquiescence of Bismarck turned to the profit of the Jews.
Absolutely. He was indebted to them.
And no wonder why that ship named after him went down in flames. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, they should have seen that coming. It was this date of 1866 which sealed the definite alliance between Prussianism and Jewry. And how long? What happened to Prussia in 1918? I mean, what's that? 52 years? Sadowa had proved the efficiency of the Prussian military machine, and henceforth, persecutors and persecuted were to march hand in hand to the conquest of world power. But already, Bismarck had found a valuable ally in the person of the Jewish socialist LaSalle.
Well, now in 1918, they don't need Prussia anymore, do they?
No, they have full control of England and America. What do they need Prussia for? Ferdinand LaSalle, the son of a rich Hebrew merchant, was born in 1825. Tormented from his youth by hatred of the Christian races, whose blood, even as a schoolboy, he hoped to shed, LaSalle early embarked on revolutionary career.
Now, who's calling him a hater of the Christian races, since there really is no Christian race, per se, is there? It would have to be hater of the white race.
Well, right. Well, yeah, right. From the perspective of traditional Christendom, the white race is the Christian race, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but yes, he's a hater of the white race.
But, you know, if the white man's not believing in Christianity, the Jew wouldn't hate him any less, would he?
Absolutely not. If we were pagans, the Jews would still want to destroy us. There's no doubt. LaSalle early embarked on a revolutionary career. Congenitally idle, dishonest, revengeful, and avowed atheist, of course, LaSalle declared himself a revolutionary by principle who would not hesitate at a reign of terror as a means to secure his ends. After the German Revolution of 1848, in which he played a leading part, LaSalle settled in Berlin, where he lived in splendor, not caring to drink wine at less than 20 or 30 marks a bottle, and entertaining his friends at gorgeous banquets.
Well, I'm sure he wasn't paying the tab. I'm sure some idiot white man was paying for him.
And one thing I wanted to say before, when you remarked on the Jews not needing pressure anymore, is that not all Jews are unified. And the Rothschilds and the Jews in Germany are actually, I think that the Rothschilds used the Jews of Germany to consistently foment insurrection, but basically they wanted the whole pie themselves, right? And that's why Germany was destroyed. That's the way I look at it. The source of LaSalle's wealth was at the Hatzfeld property, on which he lived complacently. Indeed, he frankly declared that he would willingly have married any woman who could bring him 2 or 3 million thalers of revenue.
Oh, I'm reading here from Wiki. He was a lawyer. He met a countess when he was 20 years old who had been separated from her husband. He started doing special case studies for law, and he made an argument on her behalf to get her very favorable terms. Then he had a mistress who was a baroness. He never really did any work aside from going after rich women, naive women. And I'm looking at a picture of him. He has disgusting, kinky hair, and I honestly, you know, he has big fish eyes, and I can't understand why any of these high society women would go with this creature.
Flattery. They're amazing flatterers, and women love flattery. Women fall for it. I'm not going to say every time.
He looks like he's
a lot quicker than men do.
He looks like he came out of some 1950s horror film.
But Bismarck had been quick to recognize the advantage of harnessing the Jewish agitator to the Prussian imperial machine. And so Bismarck jumped in bed with him along with how many old ladies? I'm kidding. And before long, we find LaSalle sinking his racial hatred against the Gentiles in favor of the worst oppressors of his kind. By 1859, he had become an ardent Prussian jingoist, subscribing to the whole policy of Bismarck, aiming at the absolute annihilation of Austria, whose German provinces were to form an integral part of the one and indivisible German Republic, a phrase strangely reminiscent of Anna Karsis Klutz's vision of the great Germany, the Universal Republic, which is Anna Karsis Klutz was a member of the Illuminati. before the 1848 revolution, remember? And he was one of the Illuminists who was pushing the unification of Germany under Prussia at an early time. Yet, at the same time, an enthusiastic propagandist for the Hohenzollerns, under these circumstances, it is not surprising that to the day of his death, Bismarck always spoke of LaSalle with gratitude and respect. Wonderful.
Well, when Bismarck was a dupe, wasn't he?
When Christians get in bed with Jews, horrible things always happen. Even more valuable to the cause of German imperialism was the founder of the creed known as Marxian Socialism. Karl Marx, the son of a Jewish lawyer, whose real name was Mordecai, was born at Treves in 1818. In 1843, he settled in Paris to study economics. That's a favorite course of the Jews, right? But his revolutionary activities led to his being expelled from France, and in 1845, he moved to Brussels, where, in collaboration with his German friend, Friedrich Engels, he reorganized the Communist League, and a few years later, in 1847, published the now famous Communist Manifesto.
So Marx went to a Jewish university, and he was too revolutionary for the Jews, so the Jewish professors couldn't stand him.
Well, evidently. Soon after this, he returned to Germany, where he took an active part in the 1848 revolution, and in the same year, we find him in Berlin at the head of a secret communist society, wielding the powers of life and death. For this, it is said that he was condemned to death, but succeeded in escaping to London, where he settled down for the rest of his life and devoted himself to his great book, Das Kapital. This ponderous work has been described as the Bible of the working classes. What a joke. In reality, the term, if employed at all, might be more aptly applied to his earlier production, The Communist Manifesto. To the working man, Das Kapital must be completely unintelligible, for even Marxians of the educated class are totally divided as to its meaning. Doesn't that sound like the Talmud? But
well,
to that,
every rabbi's got his own interpretation, and he's certain that every other rabbi is wrong. Evil's divided against evil.
But to that small minority amongst the working men that composes, quote, the revolutionary proletariat, the meaning of the Communist Manifesto, described by Marxians as the charter of freedom of the workers of the world, we saw what happened to them in Russia, number one, is clear enough. Here are all the diatribes against the bourgeois, the capitals with which Marat, Hebert, and Babeuf had familiarized the people. And here, in plain language, are set forth. So what she's saying is that none of this is original with Marx, right? That it has been around with Marat and Hebert and Babeuf.
And it goes back to those revolutionaries in the 12th century in France, and we can take it all the way back to the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and if we just continue it back, it goes back to Cain and Satan.
Absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt. And here in plain language is set forth the doctrines laid down in the Code of Weishaupt, the abolition of inheritance. We have that here in America. Of marriage and the family. We have that here in America. Of patriotism. Of all religion, the institution of the community of women, and the communal education of children by the state. We have just about all those things here in America. This, divested of its trappings, is the real plan of Marxian socialism, which, enveloped in the algebraical phraseology of Das Kapital, is less easy to discover. In neither work had Marx originated anything. His theory of wage slavery was, as we have seen, current during the First French Revolution, and had been continued by Vidal, a Jew, and Picquart, to whom the idea of the socialization of mines, railways, and transport was also due. His communism was that of Babeuf, of Louis Blanc, and Cabet. His internationalist schemes had been propounded by Weishaupt and Klutz. as also his attacks upon religion. His doctrine that labor is the source of all wealth had been set forth by such early English writers as Locke, Petty, Adam Smith, and later by Robert Owen. Even his theory of surplus value was not his own, but had been formulated with some vagueness by Owen, more definitely by the Chartists in their organ, The Poor Man's Guardian, in 1835, 7 years before Marx began to write. So he was another Jewish plagiarist. When we have traced these ideas to their original sources, what then is left of Marx's system? Absolutely nothing but the form in which it was conveyed. There's nothing new under the sun, right?
Well, he just took the Talmud and he put it in different language.
Right. He took the Talmud and he tried to write it on economic terms. Werner Sombart has remarked on the peculiar aptitude of the Jewish race for making use of waste product. The Jew, it appears, and we see that in all American food manufacturing today, right?
And in art, modern art.
The Jew, it appears, are the chiffonniers par excellence of the world. This, then, was the particular art of Marx, who, as we know, collected all the materials for his book on capital in the reading room of the British Museum. It was there that he found his whole system ready to hand. Can we not see him, like some veteran Jewish rag and bone merchant, going over the accumulated debris of past social schemes, passing through his finger the dry bones of dead philosophies, the shreds and tatters of worn-out doctrines, the dust and ashes of exploded theories, and with the practical cunning of the German and the Hebrew brain, right, shrewdly recognizing the use that might be made of all this lumber by skillfully welding it into one subversive whole. Now, if this is the output of the common Hebrew brain, why isn't any of it found in the Bible? Don't they miss that all the time?
How come Moses didn't talk about the dictatorship of the proletariat?
Never happened. If the Bible were a Jewish book, what would make it how could it be different than Das Kapital?
Well, if the Bible were a Jewish book, you'd have to get it at a porn shop. It wouldn't be available in church.
Exactly. And all these modern comments, even as intelligent as Nesta Webster, they all miss it all the time. The Bible has every hallmark of being an Aryan book. Marx was then an imposter from the except for the Book of Esther, I'm sorry. Marx was then an imposter from the beginning. Posing as the prophet of a new gospel, he was in reality nothing but a plagiarist, and a plagiarist without the common honesty to pay tribute to the sources whence he drew his material.
But the Jews are just that. They're a race of imposters.
For after pillaging freely from all the earlier socialists, Marx dismisses them with a sneer. For Owen, Fourier, and Cabet, the quote-unquote utopian socialists, as he describes them, Marx has nothing but a light contempt because they, quote, consistently endeavor to suppress the class struggle and to reconcile antagonisms. Whilst amongst the Republican asses of 1848, quote-unquote, Louis Blanc is referred to as a high priest of the socialist synagogue. But it was for Proudhon that Marx reserved his bitterest animosity as Bakunin the anarchist, while still under the spell of Marx, described in an illuminating passage, quote, his vanity has no bounds, a veritable Jew's vanity. This vanity, already very great, has been considerably increased by the adulation of his friends and disciples. Very personal, very jealous, very touchy, and very vindictive, like Jehovah, the God of his people, Marx will not suffer that one should recognize any other God by himself. What do I say? Now, that's another huge fault, because the Jews have never worshipped any god but themselves. So Yahweh certainly can't be the God of the Jews. Whose name they struck out of the book?
They won't even write the word God. They write G-D.
Well, right. Even the harshest critics of the Jews don't see the pattern. If you're not identity, you have it wrong. That's the bottom line. That one should even render justice to another socialist writer or worker in his presence. Proudhon, who has never been a god, but who was certainly a great revolutionary thinker, this is Bakunin speaking still, and who rendered immense services to the development of socialist ideas, became for this reason the bête noire of Marx. To praise Proudhon in his presence was to cause him a mortal offense worthy of all the natural consequences of his enmity. And these consequences are at first hatred, then the foulest calumnies. Marx has never recoiled before falsehood, however odious, however perfidious it might be. Well, he's a Jew. Well, when he thought he could make use of it without too great danger for himself against those who had the misfortune to incur his wrath.
So Bakunin is just a useful idiot, a genuine white man who's actually bought into all this hook, line, and sinker, and he actually thinks there's something to socialism. He doesn't realize that he's just a dupe.
Right, and he's attacking Marx as a liar and as a vain man, but he's defending all of the other Jewish socialists.
Of course Marx is a liar and a vain man. He's a Jew.
Oh, right. Such was the personal character of the man represented to us today as the savior of the working classes. How far was he consistent in his championship of the proletariat? Here we come to the greatest irony of all in the career of Marx. Of course it's not an irony. It's a plan, and Nesta Webster missed it because the communists Lenin and Trotsky professed to be champions of the proletariat. And what did they do to the proletariat?
Kill as many as they could.
Killed as many as they could is right. It has been seen that the principal theory proclaimed by Marx was the necessity for the overthrow of capitalism, a system founded on the exploitation of the workers by whom all wealth is produced, even though it was the Jew who invented capitalism.
And have you ever known a Jew to produce wealth?
Yet probably few of his followers have troubled to inquire whence Marx derived his own means of livelihood. We know that throughout his whole life, he never did a stroke of manual labor, the only form of work that the Marxians recognize as productive, and that his writings did not bring him in sufficient to maintain himself and his family in comfort. How then did Marx live? On the bounty of Frederick Engels. Engels has been described by the socialist Guillaume, secretary of the Internationale, as, quote, a rich manufacturer, accustomed to regard workmen as machine fodder and cannon fodder. His large fortune had been made out of a Lancashire cotton spinning, and it was he who supplemented the meager earnings of his collaborator. So we have the ludicrous situation of these two German opponents of capitalism and industrial exploitation living complacently on capital accumulated from the exploitation of English workers. How, in the face of this fact, can anyone retain a lingering belief in the genuineness of Marx's socialism? Indeed, the more we study Marx's writings, not those intended for publication, but the real expression of his opinions contained in his private correspondence, the more the conviction is borne in upon our minds that Marx never believed a word of the doctrines he professed, but that to him, socialism was merely a system to be made use of for his own ends.
Well, he wanted power and money, and Joseph Smith had already come up with Mormonism, so Marx had to do something different.
Well, right, and that's what the Jew does. He invents a system, he invents a charity, he invents something by which he can gain a comfortable living off of at the expense of everybody else. It was thus that with the rise of German social democracy under the aegis of LaSalle, Marx, and Engels, true socialism, that is to say, French socialism, died. Well, it killed itself in the 1848 revolution. It had not a leg to stand on after that. And its dry bones were taken over by the company which Bakunin described as the German Jew Company, the Red Bureaucracy. From this moment, the vein of idealism that had run through the earlier stages of the revolutionary movement ceases entirely, and socialism reduced from a utopian dream to a cut-and-dried system, practical and unaspiring as the prospectus of a German company promoter, is seen in all its heartless materialism, its ruthless Prussianism, as it first appeared in the Code of Weishaupt. Meanwhile, do you want to pick up from here?
Yeah, you want me to pick up for a while?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Illuminism had continued to develop along the line of anarchy, no longer represented merely by the visionary Proudhon, but by the fierce Slavonic force of Bakunin. Anarchy, for the first time, showed itself under its true colors. Hitherto, even such anarchic writers as Marat and Hebert had professed to entertain some scheme of reconstruction. Proudhon had formulated an elementary theory of syndicalism with which to replace the existing order. It was left to Bakunin to advocate the system of anarchy as a permanent institution, not as a transitory period necessary to traverse on the way to a regenerated social order. And I think that essentially the Jews realize they intend to destroy everything and replace it with nothing.
Well, that's right. That's right. So that they feel that they could rule over nothing.
They're
want
going
to destroy everything.
They're going to they'll burn down the mill and replace it with nothing. They'll burn down the school and replace it with nothing. And then you can just go starve in the woods.
They did it in 1917, 1918 in Russia. That's exactly what they did.
Mikhail Bakunin, or Bakunin, born in 1814, belonged to the Russian nobility and at the age of 20 entered the artillery school at St. Petersburg. He passed his examinations brilliantly, but always an incorrigible idler, spent most of his time, when quartered in a provincial town, lying on his bed in his dressing gown. Before long, he left the army, but took up no other profession, preferring to dabbling in philosophy and to meddle in his friends' affairs, one of whom, Belinsky, driven to exacerbation, wrote, "I should be capable of throwing him down and stamping on him with sabots." Quote, even his intimines and fellow anarchists, Ogareff and Herzen, had little good to say of him. "I infinitely regret having nourished this reptile," wrote the former. Quote, "he is a man with whom it repels me to shake hands," whilst Herzen described him briefly as a man with talent, but a detestable character and a malvis sui, end quote. Incidentally, Bakunin had applied the same description to Herzen. Embroiled in all these private quarrels, too indolent to do any honest work, Bakunin ended by taking up the profession of a revolutionary, a career which, like many another of his kind, he found both easy and remunerative. By dint of perpetually borrowing money from his friends, Bakunin was spared from exerting himself even in a literary way, and during the course of 7 years, 1840 to 1847, his entire output of work consisted in 6 newspaper articles. Meanwhile, his revolutionary energies found their vent in talk, endless, discursive talk with his fellow revolutionaries, lasting frequently all through the night, to the accompaniment of excellent Russian tea and sandwiches. It is thus that in 1847, we have already found him discussing with Proudhon and Sazonov the prospect of the universal revolution. Now, I wonder if Sazonov was originally inspired from Satanov. Sounds like an interesting name.
Well, you know something, and I'm going to be honest. In Hebrew, if you take a look at the Strong's Concordance and a lot of the Hebrew words, you'll find that the TS sound and the T are very often interchangeable.
And
the TS can also become a Z.
Well, it's not for nothing that the head of the Russian Jewish Congress today, his name is Satanovsky.
Well, right. Sazonov is a very interesting name, for sure.
At this period, Bakunin seems not to have formulated any definite revolutionary creed, and thus, although he vaguely regarded communism as logically impossible, he was quite content to throw in his lot with the communists of Paris, amongst them his future antagonist, Marx. 29 years later, Bakunin described their first meeting in these words. "Marx and I are old acquaintances. I met him for the first time in Paris in 1844. We were rather good friends. He was much more advanced than I was, as today he still is. Not more advanced, but incomparably more learned than I am. I knew nothing then of political economy. I had not yet got rid of metaphysical abstractions, and my socialism was only that of instinct. He, though younger than I, was already an atheist, a learned materialist, and a thoughtful socialist. It was precisely at this epoch that he elaborated the first foundations of his present system. We saw each other fairly often, for I respected him very much for his knowledge and for his devotion, passionate and serious, though always mingled with personal vanity, to the cause of the proletariat, and I eagerly sought his conversation, which was always instructive and witty, when it was not inspired by petty hatred, which, alas, occurred too frequently. There was never, however, any frank intimacy between us. Our temperaments did not permit of it. He called me a sentimental idealist, and he was right. I called him a vain man, perfidious and crafty, and I was right also." It is easy to read between the lines here to see how from the beginning Bakunin was simply a tool in the hands of Marx. They'd call him a useful idiot today, wouldn't they?
Right. And you know, I've been looking at Bakunin's biography on Wikipedia, and there's really nothing to doubt his Russian heritage with. He's just a misguided Russian. I mean, there's plenty of white people that are dupes throughout history, right? He's one of
Eve.
Them. Yeah, right. The first one.
So if they can pull it off on Eve, they should be able to pull it off on Bakunin.
I'm sure.
The shrewd German Jew, and there's no such thing, there's just Jews in Germany, clearly recognized the value of the Russian as a huge dynamic force to be made, use of, and then cast aside when it served its purpose, hence useful idiot. Before the revolution of 1848, Bakunin, like Marx, was expelled from Paris. But after the explosion of February, he contrived to return and join himself to the extreme party, with whom he passed his nights preaching revolution, equality of salaries, the leveling down of all classes in the name of equality. But Cassidere and Flocken, exacerbated by his tirades, finally broke off on a mission to the Slavs in the hope of breaking his neck. "What a man, what a man," said Cassidere. "The first day of a revolution, he is a treasure. The second, he is only good to shoot." He's a useful idiot. Isn't that what happens?
That's what we've seen time and again, you know, throughout Russia number one and the history of Stalin and 20th Soviet rule in Russia, that they always got rid of their useful idiots.
So,
they would use all of these goyim that align themselves with their ideals, and they would use them, and as soon as they did something for them, they were expendable, and they were eliminated as possible competitors.
It's an issue of, thank you, white baron, for allying with us. You thought you were going to improve the cause of the workers. Well, we no longer need you. Bang!
Well, that's the same thing that happened during the Reign of Terror in the French Revolution, right?
Absolutely. Didn't the Duke d'Orléans expected to run the show, and he lost his head.
Right.
Herzen, who records this expression of opinion, adds that Cassidieri himself needed shooting the day before the revolution began. Bakunin's journey eastwards effectively rid France of its presence for many years, for after taking part in the revolutionary outbreaks in Russia, Prague, and finally in Dresden, he was arrested at Chemnitz and imprisoned first at Altenburg, then at Königstein, then taken in chains to Prague, transferred to Olmutz, where he remained chained to the wall for 5 months, and last of all, given over to the Russian government, by which he was imprisoned in the fortress of Peter and Paul in May 1851. 2 months later, Count Orlov came to visit him and urged him to write a confession of his misdeeds to the emperor as to a father confessor. Bakunin complied, but Nicholas I, on reading the document, observed briefly, "He is a brave boy with a lively wit, but he is a dangerous man and must be kept under lock and key." Accordingly, Bakunin remained in prison for a time in St. Peter and Paul, later at Schulesburg, where he remained 3 years, during which time he contracted scurvy and all his teeth fell out.
Now at St. Peter and Paul, that was where they had that was the big prison used by the
Bolsheviks.
By the Bolsheviks during 1917, 1918.
The same prison they ranted and raved against and said should be torn down.
Yeah, right.
And I'm sure had the peasants not torn down the Bastille, they would have been putting people in the Bastille to leave them to rot.
Right.
On the accession of Alexander II, a fresh demand was made for a reprieve, but the new emperor, on being shown Bakunin's confession to his predecessor, remarked, "I see not the least repentance in this letter," and sent him to Siberia. The Jews, on the other hand, they would just take some out in the woods and shoot him in the back of the head.
Well,
they
wouldn't have fed him for 10 years. They'd have just shot him in the head. It would have been over with.
Here, Bakunin spent 4 quite pleasant years free to move about. He actually, for the only time in his life, took up a little work and finally married a Polish girl who shared all his aspirations. "I am completely happy," he wrote in 1860. "Ah, how sweet it is to live for others, especially when it is for a charming woman."
Shared which aspirations? The aspirations that got him landed in prison?
Well, what was she doing in prison with him?
Well, no, he was in Siberia, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she must have been in trouble to end up in Siberia from Poland. It seems like that's a possibility, yeah.
But peace and quiet could not content the restless spirit of Bakunin for long. The revolutionary fever was on him, and he craved to be back again at his old game of agitation. The emancipation of the serfs, which took place in the following year, stirred him but mildly. In this immense concession to the cause of liberty, he saw only a means of shaking the imperial authority. And at the end of the same year, he succeeded in escaping from Siberia, whence he traveled across Japan and America to London. He must have had a lot of help along the way. He's pretty well-connected and well-financed, isn't he?
Well, it's clear to me he had help along the way because he ended up in London. I mean, it's pretty clear.
You just don't walk out of Siberia without help along the way.
And end up in London. If you're on a run, you really, and you don't have help, you're going to end up in Hong Kong or something. Anywhere but Seoul, anywhere but London.
Here, Bakunin, received with open arms by Ogarev and Herzen, found himself once more in a congenial atmosphere.
Well, he knew he'd find, at the least, he knew he'd find fellow travelers there, right?
Absolutely. Surrounded by conspirators of all nationalities, meaning they're Jews from different countries, he was able to get to work on fresh plots, on schemes for stirring up the Poles, and organizing revolutions everywhere. Herzen has thus described his activities at this crisis. Bakunin renewed his youth. He was in his element. It is not only the rumbling of insurrection, the noise of the clubs, the tumult in the streets and public places, nor even the barricades that made up his happiness. He loved also the movement of the day before, the work of preparation, that life of agitation, yet at the same time rendered continuous by conferences, those sleepless nights, those parleyings and negotiations, rectifications, chemical ink, ciphers, and signs agreed upon beforehand. And Herzen, who took revolution more seriously, adds that Bakunin excited himself exactly as if it were a question of preparing a Christmas tree. That annoyed me. End quote. It is easy to understand that to a man of Bakunin's temperament, an existence of this kind, maintained as ever by the charity of his friends, was infinitely preferable to a life of honest toil such as most human beings are condemned to lead. Indeed, in the above description, we find the key to many an agitator's career, and we cannot wonder that as long as revolution provides constitutional idlers with a lucrative and amusing profession, the world should continue to toss on the waves of unrest. I have dwelt at some length on the character and career of Bakunin because more than anyone, he seems to me to embody the spirit of anarchy, a spirit widely different, indeed diametrically opposed to that of state socialism. Which is why Bakunin would have to die the day after the revolution, isn't it?
Right.
The anarchists.
Well, right. They use them and exhaust them, and as soon as they get control, that they eliminate everybody to help them get to where they are.
The anarchist is undoubtedly a more amiable being than the state socialist. Instead of wishing to cut everyone down to the same pattern, he desires, on the contrary, to give all men unbounded liberty to develop along whatever lines they please. The idler should be free to idle and live on other men's labors, the drunkard to drink himself into a condition of maudlin imbecility, the murderer to cut throats until he wearies of the pastime, the thief to continue helping himself to other people's goods until he's accumulated enough to satisfy himself. Well, what if what I desire to do is to shoot the thief? And that's liberty, isn't it?
Well, right.
Exaggerated individualism is the keynote of his system. Liberty, not equality, is his goal. His belief in the amiability of human nature endows him with a
bonhomie,
not to be found amongst the communists who regard their fellow men as creatures to be dragooned into obedience to the dictates of the state, by which, of course, they mean themselves. The Jews always say they're going to destroy the state and bring about a classless, stateless society, and all they do is get rid of the white elite and bring in Jewish elite.
Exactly. That's all they've done. And people just don't see it. And they fall for it. We fell for it again. We fall for it every election here.
Every 4 years, change we can believe in. You know, you vote out Jew 1 and you vote in Jew 2. The difference between the two is that which exists between the amiable eccentric who, believing in the innate benevolence of the entire animal kingdom, wishes to open all the cages in a menagerie and leave the wild beasts free to roam about the world, and the lion tamer who loves at the crack of his whip to see king of beasts and performing poodle alike meekly rotating on a merry-go-round. It is easy, therefore, to understand that anarchists, far more than their dour opponents, the state socialists, have succeeded in endearing themselves to the people with whom they come in contact. The vision of the Russian giant in his big hat was remembered affectionately long afterwards by the inhabitants of Lugano, where Bakunin spent some years, and later on his disciple, Prince Kropotkin, made himself beloved in London drawing rooms. The truth is that to the Western mind, such beings are impossible of comprehension. Deceived by the outward urbanity of the anarchists, it fails to realize that beneath the smiling surface there lurks a tiger ready to be aroused by the smell of blood. It cannot believe that people can really exist who love violence for its own sake, who crave to burn and murder and destroy, and they're called Edomites.
Well, right, and they admit that they're destroyers all the time, right? Maurice Samuel,
absolutely.
Didn't
he said that we Jews are destroyers and will remain destroyers because we want a world of our own.
Absolutely.
They want this world.
That they want to reform God's creation in their image, which is a pretty macabre image.
Mm-hmm. But in Eastern Europe, creatures of this kind have always existed. And we find the exact prototype of Bakunin, in the Baron Ungern von Sternberg, who had pursued a career of crime at the beginning of the century in his island of Dago. The favorite pastime of this robber baron, who had vowed hatred to the whole human race, the emperor in particular, was to lure ships to their destruction by means of a lighthouse installed in the tower of his castle. As soon as a vessel was on the point of wrecking, the baron descended to the beach, embarked secretly with several clever and determined men whom he kept to help him in his nocturnal expeditions. He received the foreign mariners, finished them off in the darkness instead of rescuing them, and after having strangled them, he pillaged their ship. All this less by cupidity than by pure love of evil, by a disinterested zeal for destruction. Disbelieving in everything, and above all in justice, he regarded moral and social disorder as the closest analogy to the state of man here below, and civil and political virtues as harmful chimeras, since they only oppose nature without subduing it.
I have to go back into Greek mythology and determine whether the sirens were Jews, right?
Baron von Sternberg seems to me to be the quintessential Jew.
Well, yes, absolutely. He's luring ships to their destruction so that he could pillage them. The Greeks had myths about the sirens, which were seductresses, which lured ships to their destruction. And it seems to me that Baron von Sternberg was a modern-day siren, right?
Would you like to shall we continue on, or shall we end
here?
Well,
we should probably end here and finish this chapter next week, right?
Okay, excellent. So we'll pick up next week then, most likely. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.